Our next speaker, Kurt Harnick, is director of multimedia marketing for the Telos Alliance. And he's bringing 40 years of experience to the broadcasting industry, and he has expertise in IP audio and voiceover IP. Kirk's other interests include piloting private airplanes and amateur radio, and he's an active board member with the Society of Broadcast Engineers. Today, Kirk is applying his expertise to an innovative presentation on the topic of adaptive multi-rate audio streaming. Welcome with me now to the podium, Kurt Harnick.
Thank you. Boy, well, you write your own intro, and my golly, it's going to be good. Glad you're here. And 40, I have been doing this for about 40 years, so I have 44 minutes left, so I have 1 minute per year to talk about this. Okay. So adaptive multi-rate streaming is the topic. And, as content providers, content creators, sure, we all have transmitters. We love to take care of those, or hate to, depending. After listening to Chris Tarr, I feel more optimistic about taking care of my transmitters. I live a seven-hour drive from most of my transmitters in Mississippi, and I try to keep it that way. But we create content that also goes on the internet, and probably every station represented in this room is streaming right now. But is it as easy to get as it should be, or it could be? Is it as easy for your listeners to click a button and listen to what they want as, say, Pandora? Because that's really easy. On my Uber ride over here last night from the Madison Airport, the Uber driver was a 20-year-old kid, okay, listening to classic rock, Creedence Clearwater Revival. I thought, dude, how do you know about this music? He says, Pandora. And that's his go-to, is Pandora. It's easy. And there's fewer commercials. Of course, there's a lot of things he's missing out on by not having local. And we can go through all those arguments. But we're going to talk about how to make things maybe a little bit easier and better for your listeners who listen on mobile devices, and more, they're going to be listening on cars. Let's get a quick review of the streaming process, the overview. You've got your audio source, whatever that is. That's your content that you've created. You're a content creator. And typically, it'll go into some kind of an audio processor for streaming. It could be a simple one. It could be a more complicated one. And after that processor that's intended for streaming, it's going to get encoded. Typically, a lot of stations are doing an MP3 stream. Maybe you're also doing an AAC stream. And then from there, I'm showing here a functional diagram of a lot of audio encoding products. Of course, I'm going to use examples from the Telos Alliance, because that's what I'm familiar with. But a lot of them have a confidence monitor built in. So with products from the Telos Alliance, you can connect directly to it, bypassing your CDN, your content distribution network, and listen to it directly. Make sure you're putting out what you think you're putting out. But then a lot of products, and this is representative of some of ours, you'll have a little switching matrix, and from there you can decide which encoded stream, not ready for streaming yet, it's really a series of frames, which format it's going to go out in. And so we typically have a format for an Icecast server, another format for feeding a Shoutcast server, and a couple of other formats as well. We're going to be talking about the newest format, which is adaptive multi-rate. And there's a couple different ways to do that too now, so we'll get to that. From there, of course, it goes to your CDN for distribution out to the wide, wide world. Or you may be doing your own CDN yourself. There's also metadata. And typically, metadata gets encoded with the stream itself. There are some CDNs that want you to, either instead of or in addition to, send a metadata stream directly to them. And maybe they have some other fancy-schmancy way of incorporating that into their audio player. So there's different ways to do that. Now, thinking about bit rates, hey, it's amazing where the internet is going and where bit rates are. 2 years ago, as an experiment, I was talking to one of our support guys. Okay, that wasn't the experiment. But it was Brian Jones out in Washington State. Now, Brian, I don't know if you know, he sings barbershop music and a championship, really a high-class barbershop quartet. He knows a lot about music, he loves music, and he's got a fantastic collection and playlist of Christmas music. So I thought, well, this will be fun. I'll stream his Christmas music to my house from his house, and I'll just play it in my house. And so we each have a Telos Zip 1, so a codec, right? And we thought, well, just as an experiment, let's not try MP3 or AAC. Let's try linear audio. Let's just try that. So 2.5 megabits per second, linear audio, from Vancouver, Washington State, to Nashville, Tennessee. We streamed it for 6 weeks. I wasn't in the office 24 hours a day, but I was there typically 6 or 8 hours a day, and I never heard it burp once. Now, he's got home cable internet, I've got home cable internet, and it just worked for 6 solid weeks. We shut it off after that. We got tired of the Christmas music. So my point there is, you know, linear is wonderful. It sounds so beautiful, but it's still not practical to the end user. You know, we have cars coming out with 4G LTE available in them, and I know there's more technologies coming along. There'll be 5G, and it's going to be amazing. But as we get millions of cars on the road with cell sites that I'm sure will have trouble keeping up, just as they have on transitions from 2G to 3G and 3G to 4G, and they'll have infrastructure, you know, back-end infrastructure issues too, we've got to keep some kind of a low data rate. And we've got to keep a data rate, or maybe even have a selection of data rates that the listener, hey, if I'm in a great area, I want to hear 256 kilobits AAC, or, well, probably not MP3, but, you know, a high bit rate. But if I'm in a bad area where there's poor coverage, you know, going on an interstate between cities, I'm up and down hills, and, oh, there's the next tower, basically places where your cell phone would drop anyway, right? We're looking at a much lower data rate and doing some buffering. And that's what we'd like to do. So your mobile data bandwidth probably ought to be down in this neighborhood using HEAAC V2 or the HEAAC coding formats. These actually sound pretty good, I mean, entertainment quality at low bit rates, especially if the audio that's been used to feed them has been linear the whole time before. You know, we don't want to do cascading if we can, especially if we've got a really low bit rate to follow. So let's look at a few different codecs here. You know, MP3, we're all familiar with that. My stations don't happen to stream in MP3, and we don't get any complaints. But if you've been streaming in MP3 for years, you've probably got some people out there with an old player here or there, and if you took that away, it wouldn't work for them. But MP3, we think of it as being old and stodgy, but it's everywhere, right? It's the first codec of the popular ones to start sounding grungy at lower bit rates. So we really try to keep MP3, you know, not at a low bit rate, if we can. Then there's the AAC family of codecs. There's regular AAC. Technically, we tend to actually be using AAC LC, which is AAC low complexity. It's not quite the full AAC, but the implementation of it is a bit easier, and so that's what most people go to. If you buy songs from iTunes that are 256 kilobit AAC, they're actually AAC LC. But a lot of folks just leave the LC off. So then there's high efficiency AAC. That's typically used at these bit rates, 48 to 96K, although it'll go right up to 320K. Then there's high efficiency AAC V2, which actually, hey, my stations tend to stream at about 48 kilobits. I'm happy with them. 64 is better, but 48 is what we buy from our CDN. And then there's this new codec out there called extended high efficiency AAC. Yeah, these names are from Fraunhofer. They're not really good marketing names, but this is what they call them. Extended HEAAC actually works down to about 12 kilobits. I don't know that you want to listen to 12 kilobits all day long, but XHEAAC actually has this broad range from 16 up to 320K. And when it's up at the same bit rates as the others, it sounds just like the others. There's no detriment to using it. The benefit of XHEAAC is that it works equally well on voice and music. And if you've ever had to deal with one or the other, you know that with a voice codec, like is typically used in cell phones, AMR wideband or SELP or one of these, those sound pretty good on voice down to some pretty low bit rates, but they sound horrible on music. And vice versa. Music codec, AAC, does not sound very good on voice at really low bit rates. Well, Fraunhofer was able to combine technologies, doing some incredible seamless switching and getting what they call a unified codec that actually does work well down to low bit rates. Again, you don't want to listen to this necessarily all day long, but if you're in a bad data area and you've got to get 16 kilobits of XHEAAC for a while, you know, it's like the AM station when you go under a bridge, right, or through a tunnel. It gets bad, but if you're listening to that ball game, you want to hear it. Same thing. We sure don't recommend, even though they're fun for engineers like us to play with, real audio, Windows Media Audio, FLAC, Ogg Vorbis, you know, these are fun to play with, but there just isn't uptake out there. So that's not really worthwhile to put out there to the public. And a little quick reminder of how these different codecs are related from Fraunhofer. There's the original AACLC. They added spectral band replication. Yes, it's a fake high-end, but it's an amazing way they do it. Then they added parametric stereo, which basically dropped the stereo separation to 24 dB for HEAACV2, and then extended HEAAC unified coding and for speech and music. Now, you know, transmission mediums require peak control to avoid loss of headroom, right, and eventual system distortion. Well, precision peak limiting is employed to accomplish this with your transmission systems. Hard limiting or peak clipping is used in conventional broadcasting, and, you know, we've all figured out ways to make that work pretty well. The method does not technically degrade the system, although overuse of final limiting is a subjective adjustment, and too much can degrade performance. Hard limiting does work as a precision peak control with FM and stereo and AM, but it's not okay for a psychoacoustic encoder. A psychoacoustic encoder is just totally flummoxed and upset and frustrated by clipping. So we really need to avoid that at all costs. It's because of the extra spectral bandwidth that it makes. It doesn't know all these artifacts that you create from clipping. It doesn't know that from the audio that you actually wish to encode. So it tries to encode everything, and it all gets pretty bad then. Now, the processors and encoders that my company makes, that Telos makes, the encoders all come with a processor. But if you're going to use your own processor, here's some advice that we've certainly come up with over the years. Really avoid dense processing, especially density created by clipping. Slow down your attack and release times. Check for full headroom at the input to the encoder. So here you are processing, but you're not clipping. So you may have some peaks going now and then. Make sure that those peaks are not overdriving the input to the encoder. That's one of the common things we've seen from folks who are using, you know, some other setup besides ours. At low coding bit rates, you might want to reduce the audio bandwidth going in so that AAC or especially your MP3 encoder operating at 32 kilobits or some such doesn't have to try to encode audio that's up at, you know, 15, 16, 18, 18 kilohertz. You really want to reduce that, and you'll get better mid-ranges out of the whole thing. Certainly don't boost the high-end energy, and like we said before, don't use a clipper. Instead, use precision peak control using look-ahead limiting. Let's look at some of the features that you'll find in a typical audio processor for streaming. You're going to find a wideband input processor. You find that there's as with on-the-air processors, you'll find that you can really affect the tonal balance or the tonal energy by affecting the release time of a wideband input. If the release time is really fast, then you're going to be feeding a lot more dynamics to the multiband processors that follow. So you'll get a much more densed up sound by speeding up the release time in the initial wideband compressor. This product has some bass enhancement features that are available in it. Then comes some multiband processing right there, and there's a few controls on here for adjusting low, medium, and high bands. This is a three-band processor. And then finally, there's the final limiter. And this is a properly designed look-ahead limiter that's got a little secret sauce feature in it that helps mitigate this problem. A classic design look-ahead limiter will create intermodulation distortion. Unfortunately, that's how it has to work, because it's going to, ahead of a peak, it's going to reduce the volume. And then after the peak happens, it's going to increase that volume to leave room for that peak to occur. Well, that very volume change in itself, in preparation for and after the peak occurs, is a change in volume. It's intermod distortion, and because it's creating a low-frequency element there. And so a classic look-ahead limiter is going to have this problem. I'm not allowed to understand what the block is that says smooth right there, but this is a drawing from Frank Foti from actually 12 years ago or so, when he and his team developed a really smart look-ahead limiter that mitigates or anticipates this intermod distortion that a look-ahead limiter can create. So just know that's in all the look-ahead limiters that we're making. All right, let's look at encoders. The cool thing about, or the frustrating thing about being a manufacturer and competing with other encoder manufacturers is a lot of them have this sales price of free or close to free. So there's NiceCast out there. There's EdCast out there. Gosh, what is this? SimpleCast, not quite free, but very low priced. And then there's this one. What is that one? RadioCaster. And then there's even one called Butt. So if you're not paying any money for the encoder, then we really have no idea how you could possibly getting actual reference encoding code. And a lot of folks don't know this, but the standards for MP3 or for AAC, those are actually playback standards. If you're smart enough to design an encoding algorithm that allows the audio you've encoded to play back on a reference MP3 player, then you've got an MP3 encoder. So there are open source MP3 encoders and AAC encoders out there. In fact, in some countries, they have to be published as open source because of free speech issues. So, I mean, you can publish it if it's out in the open. So they're out there. And my point about all that is it's not the reference code. And so another little interesting secret about our business is over the years, the cost of the reference code from Fraunhofer has decreased dramatically. And so, am I supposed to say we pass the savings on to you? The point is it wouldn't cost you any less to buy an encoder from us that didn't have the reference code. So you might as well get the reference code. So we get put the good stuff in there. Let's see. Let me move along here and get to... Okay. So we do the audio processing, as we mentioned. Then we're going to move into encoding. And again, describing our encoders, and I guess this probably works for other ones that are on the market too. That's right, this is a movie with no sound. So you can have more than one encoder encoding this audio that you've processed. And each encoder can have its own processor, or with some of our products, you can make one encoder, one processing instance, and encode several streams from it after that. So in this case, we've got a low bit rate encoder that's operating at 56 kilobits, HEAACv2, and then I've got another one that's 56 kilobits, which could have a high bit rate one as well. You can have multiple simultaneous destinations also in here. So you can take each encoder and tell it, okay, I want to make a stream from this encoder to go to an IceCast server. And I want to go to another IceCast server that's in a different location as a backup. And I want another one to go to this Shoutcast server. And I want another one to be available as a confidence monitor. So you can do all that from each instance of encoding that you're doing there. I mentioned earlier that a three-band audio processor is pretty appropriate and pretty normal that we include that. But there's also an Omnia 9-style processor that's available. And just so you can see what some of the stuff you can do is, I think we have a little movie here where we can take a look.
So you see I have three different stream encoders set up here. Omnia 3, Omnia 9, both of those at 64 kilobits, and an Omnia 9 feeding an HLS stream encoder. Well, let's look at the Omnia 9 64 kilobit, and on this one, I have set it up for Omnia 9 processing. If we go to the configuration of the stream encoder itself, you see I've chosen Omnia 9. And for the processing preset selection, it says, use NF remote to change preset. And that's the way Omnia 9 works. It uses a separate program for very lightning fast speed and the Omnia toolkit to show you exactly what's going on. In fact, if I click on the adjustment for the Omnia 9, it even tells me right here how to use the NF remote software in case I'm not familiar with it. So let's do that. Let's minimize this view and go start the NF remote software that's installed on this computer. And I have it here already highlighted. This is a shortcut to go monitor and configure the WKXY0964 stream, which is the one we were just looking at. So if I double-click on this, Windows Software, there I have an instant connection to the Omnia 9 processing on that on that processing instance. So I've already set this up with a lot of windows to see exactly what's going on, but this is some of the power that's included with the Omnia 9 processing. There's a whole section for the undo, the multiband expansion, and the declipping that's available there. Then there's all the pre-processing, stereo enhancement if you want that. Input levels are shown, the wideband AGC and the multiband AGC, plus a second wideband compressor and limiters, and then the output showing there. Then there is all kinds of windows, and these are all configurable to show different types of processing that's available with the Omnia 9. If you're familiar with the Omnia 9 or the Omnia 7 FM processor, then you'll be comfortable right away in adjusting this one. By the way, if you want a really pretty look, you can set this for displays only, get rid of all the buttons, and there you have an absolutely gorgeous display of the Omnia 9 processing parameters and the audio going through it, including real-time analyzers, oscilloscopes, FFT displays. You also have a graph over time to see loudness. I'm running just one song after another out of an iPod here, so you can see that there's a blank space between the songs, and then input and output levels. That and more are all available. We can close out of that now, and that's a look at how to set up and get into and adjust Omnia 9 processing.
So let's get into the subject at hand, and that is going to be adaptive streaming. First of all, let's look at traditional streaming for just a slide or two, Shoutcast and Icecast. Here are some of the downsides of traditional streaming. Bit rates are fixed. There's no auto selection of bit rates. Sure, on your website, you may say, click here for our low bit rate stream, click here for our high bit rate stream. My family doesn't know what to do with that. Just as often, just click the first one. And what if your conditions change? The publisher has to make links available for the bit rates. The listener has to select them. If you pick a low bit rate, you get lower quality audio, even if you had higher bit rate available. Or you get the stuttering audio problem or the buffering problem if you pick the high bit rate and you don't have that available. And sometimes, I think it's less often now, at least in hotels, but it's maybe more or as often in corporate. It's certainly university environments. Oh, my goodness, try to get out of a university with any, with Skype or anything else. Or even a large radio network in the U.S. I mean, all the engineers order their own separate internet feed for the rack room. But ports 8000, 8888, and 1935 are often blocked in certain corporate environments, and so streaming becomes pretty tough to do. There's three different standards. Of course, there couldn't be one. There are three standards for adaptive multi-rate streaming that we can start to look at. Apple HLS. HLS stands for HTTP Live Streaming. Microsoft Smooth Streaming, and MPEG Dash. It's file-based streaming, so it's not a constant connection with each user. It's, oh, you want the file? Sure. Oh, you want the next file? You were just here 5 seconds ago. Yeah, okay, here's the next file. Ordinary file servers can distribute these sequential audio files, so it doesn't have to. You don't have to run Shoutcast. You don't have to run Icecast server. You have a file server, and that means that an Amazon Web Services server can do this. Microsoft IIS or Apache can all do this. The server itself is optimized to serve files. That's what it does. Standard HTTP access over port 80, so it's typically not blocked, maybe even never blocked, and it's just like serving web pages. Of course, as I mentioned, there are these three standards. We're going to look at Apple HLS because that seems to be the one that's most common taking off. And if you've got an Apple device on you or in you or at your home or wherever, it already does this. It's already built in. What happens here is let's go to the diagram here and have a look. So there's your audio processor. Your processed audio comes out and it goes to three or more. Encoders, and they could even be different algorithms. Typically, they'd be in the same family. So you might run AAC at 256. You might run HEAAC at 96. You might run HEAAC V2 at 48, and you might run XHEAAC at something even less. And you know what? Someday, when XHEAAC decoders are ubiquitous, like AAC and MP3 are pretty much now, we could just use one coding algorithm, XHEAAC, for all these different bit rates. So we're making three different streams of frames, one from each of these three bit rates. And by the way, if you're going to be on Apple's streaming, then 256 is the top rate that you're supposed to do using AAC, and then you can pick your own below that, but you're supposed to do at least three. All right, next slide shows those streams coming in, and here's the thing you need to learn from this, or one thing you need to learn from this presentation, and that is the file segmenter. So the file segmenter takes these incoming streams and puts that data into a file. And you choose the length of the file, the audio represented there, but typically, apparently for audio streaming, we're choosing about 5 seconds. So 5 seconds or 5,000 milliseconds worth of audio goes into each of those files. And the key to the segmenter is it's exactly precisely the same audio in each file. So it's you know, the frames are cut, spliced, trimmed, put right there, exactly the same for, in this case, all three different bit rates. So that if your decoder switches from one to a different speed, you won't hear a break in the audio. The audio quality might change to your perception. It probably won't be to your perception, but it'll do so seamlessly at that point. Well, as soon as each file is full, and these files are going to be fairly small. They're 5 seconds worth of audio, right? But they're going to be different sizes. Then they're going to either be served from that server, or more typically, they're going to be FTP'd up to some FTP server, a file server somewhere, or the FTP to a file server. And that file server has a folder structure on it that we're going to look at here in just a moment. Typically, you might set the file server up to keep 15 seconds worth of audio on it. So once it has three files, then when a new one comes in, it drops the oldest one. And it does that and does that and does that. And whenever it does that, it updates a little manifest file that it has for each of the bit rates. Okay, manifest file. The file there that's at the bottom, stream.m3u8, that m3u8 is the extension name for Apple HLS streams, video or audio. And let me click this button here and you'll see graphically what happens. When the client reaches out and says, oh, I want to hear this stream, the first thing it gets is this little M3U8 file. And the first M3U8 file, also called a manifest file, just says, oh, you want to hear this stream? Well, I've got it in these different bit rates, and here's how long each one of those might take you to download, here's a bit about some metadata about those streams. And here's where the streams are. Here's where the manifest file for each stream is located. So then the device says, oh, thanks for that info. I'll go look at the stream that I want. So it goes and picks out the stream that it wants, and there's a manifest file for each stream. So, and the manifest file for each stream is updated every, in this case, 5 seconds, with the actual file names, and those are sequential. So it knows to download exactly which file from the folder. And so it'll do that, and it'll pick whichever bit rate is good. There's different ways that manufacturers or software writers could write their program. The point is, the player on your device is where the smarts are. It decides, am I going to start at a low bit rate to get that file in here fast, or am I going to start with the highest quality and just see if things work out? Well, as an example, I've got a 6-year-old boy, and sometimes we'll watch cartoons together, right? So we turn on Netflix and we pick a cartoon, and for the first either 5 or 10 seconds, it looks fuzzy, right? It's a little pixelated. It looks low bit rate on the big screen TV. And then, but I'm thinking, you know, why would it look like that when I've got a 100 megabit cable connection? And then a few seconds later, bam, it's crystal clear. Why? Because the Netflix player grabbed the lowest bit rate version first to get it started, because kids and dads are impatient. And then it says, wait a minute, that was a 10-second video file, and I downloaded that sucker in 0.076 seconds. I think we can do better. So it goes and grabs either the next speed, or it estimates that the biggest file will be okay. And so that's how that works. And then if the bit rate got bad, hey, man, I just downloaded 10 seconds worth of video, and my goodness, it took 11.2 seconds to do it. I better try a lower bit rate. That's what the client is doing. And so different clients will have different priorities or algorithms, but that's the whole idea. Now, what's in these files? This is the upper one on the upper right. That's the contents of the main manifest file. This is, by the way, this example is one of my radio stations. It's in Greenville, Mississippi, WIQQ. And we're going to listen to a stream of it here in just a minute. But when you go to it, there's a list of the other files and some data about them. And so I'm going to go pick out one of those files, 128 kilobits per second, and there's the manifest file, the lower right one, for that particular stream. And so it has the sequence numbers of the files that are in there, and so the player knows what to do with that. All right. The whole thing about adaptive being adaptive, and just to get this fixed in your head a little bit more, I'll just show you a couple examples. The black line is you moving around, perhaps mobile, perhaps you're on Wi-Fi, perhaps you're on a hotel, and at, 8 p.m., it's hard to get your email. But at 2 in the morning, you can watch videos. So you've got three different streams available, and, of course, it'll pick the right one. Maybe a better graphical example would be this one. So a 3G network is over there on the left, a LAN speed pretty stable in the middle, and on Wi-Fi there on the right. So the red line is the speed of the file that it's downloading, and the gray line is your actual bit rate at any given moment. Let's see. So in my case, using the same software, I'm creating the top stream there. That encoder instance is feeding our CDN, which happens to be SecureNet systems. And then the lower one is my HLS stream. And I'm going to skip through this metadata stuff real quick so we can get to the point of the metadata stuff here is that the point I wanted to make with this is that there is metadata middleware available, and I just sure highly recommend it. This is the representative of the stuff from Arctic Palm in Canada, and they just are really good at taking metadata from different sources, aggregating it, and then spitting it out to the right places and the right devices, whether it's your RDS or a stream or taking metadata from your EAS system. All right. And just a little bit more about metadata, that there's filters for different things. One more thing here, and that is these modern encoders. I say modern, I mean at least the ones that we're making, they have a lot of remote control capabilities in case you want to get fancy. This just seems like the kind of thing that Chris Tarr would jump right into. I haven't. I know this stuff exists, but of course there's the web GUI, and it's HTML5, so you don't need Flash, and you don't need Java to make that work. There is a RESTful API, so if you're a programmer and you want to work with your encoder, make it change processing, change bit rates, change where the stream is going to on command, it can use the RESTful API to do that. SNMP is fully supported in those. Also, programming scripts you can write in different languages to control it. And one of our products, the ZipStream R2, has hardware GPI on the back. You can program it to do various different functions, and then you've got GPIO over IP with Livewire. Okay. People ask us, well, which is better to do streaming? Should I do hardware or should I do software? Well, it's really whatever you're comfortable with. So companies like Telos, we make stuff in either hardware or software, whichever is your preference there. All right. I'm going to wrap things up with this thing that I've been working on. I've been reading a lot of books to my six-year-old, and he's starting to read back to me, so that's a good thing. So let me see if this is appropriate for him, for me to read to him tomorrow night when I get home. The stream would not stream. It was too fast to play. We drove in the car in stark silence that day. Our old favorite station, our most favorite team, would play on without us, for the stream was a dream. Each second, the bits that wanted to play would buffer and spill and retransmit away. Listening by mobile or in this hotel, it stutters. We wait, frustrated as hell. Maybe I better not read that to the kid. The station, it offers but one choice or two for bit rates and format. We've tried them. Have you? Funny thing is, my YouTube's okay. Netflix works too. It's amazing that way. I hear the audio, but the video's slow. How does it work? Soon you will know. It's adaptive, my friend. It knows about bandwidth, never piling too much on my media sandwich. Keep listening, my friend. Turn it up. Make a racket. Slow, medium, fast. You'll get every packet. The brain's in the player. The server just serves. From student to mayor, it won't get on your nerves. HTTP live streaming. It's a mouthful to me. Sounds complicated, no, but it's easy, you see. To get a big audience, let them click a small link for a sound massive, captive, and attractive at a stream that's adaptive. All right, now, I got one more thing for you, and that is we're going to take a quick listen to, let's see if I can make this work here real quick. I'm going to try to mirror my images so I can not be terribly confused by this. So I've got a shortcut, and I can't let a million people listen to this because it's just being served out by my server. But if I go to bit.ly/WIQQ-HLS, ready for audio? Let's see how long it takes when I hit enter.
First you both go out your way and the vibe is feeling strong and what's small turn to a friendship turn to a bond.
So what I saw there was, it took 3 seconds to start playing audio. I'm just going to try it again. I've got a shortcut up there, so.
And when brotherhood comes first, then the line will never be crossed.
Now, I'm not convinced that what didn't have that buffer. So let me open a new window and hit that again.
How can we not talk about family when family's all that we got?
So that's, could be 10 or 15 second old audio, but it started playing right away. Unfortunately, none of the players right now show you the bit rate that you're getting right now, so I have to use other tools like a router to see how fast it is. And, you know, nowadays, I need to get some tools to actually impair the stream so I can hear it go to different bit rates. But point there being that I'm playing this back on Chrome with an extension. It plays back on Android devices natively. It plays back on every iOS device natively, this HLS. And this particular, I know the screen's black, it's not handling any metadata right now. This plugin was actually meant for HLS video. So it works with audio just fine. Right now, I understand that Triton is going to be supporting Apple HLS streaming. It so happens that many other CDNs are not handling it yet. But given the advantages and the simplicity, I just got to believe that this is really going to be a thing, especially when we get millions of cars on the road all trying to stream and wanting to not, you know, to get the best available at the time, but also be able to shift gears, go to a lower bit rate, and give you audio while you're driving in areas that have a poor data rate. So I'm ready for any questions. If there's any questions you want to ask. Are you walking toward the mic, or are you walking to come throw me off the stage? Here we go.
Apple HLS. How is Apple licensing that for play out on Windows and Android? Do you know how they are monetizing this?
I don't know. I do know that players like the JW player, which is multi-platform, will play Apple HLS. I know that for our part, in order to be up to date on all the latest and the protocols and everything from Apple, we just had to become Apple developers. So I think we have a grand total investment with everything we're doing with them of $400 a year or so. But I'm not aware of per instance licensing fees for implementing it. The adaptive streaming tech is, in a way, it's really pretty simple, right? You got this container, this file, and you're playing audio. And the audio isn't owned by Apple. Just the protocol of how the server and the client interact with each other was developed by Apple. We're going to do this, and this is how it works. This Chrome extension that I got a couple days ago, because up until I got that extension, it doesn't play natively on a Chrome browser on a Mac. But it does play natively on a Chrome browser on an Android phone. I say natively, it asks you what helper app do you want, and the sound player that comes with Android works fine. So if you have an Android phone, you can play back Apple HLS streams. And then, of course, and then in Safari, it works fine. It just plays. I think that this is not going to be the only way you need to stream for now, but sure can see this being a thing. Smooth streaming is supported, and as soon as MPEG Dash has some uptake in the audio world, right now it's got video uptake, especially for backhaul, in a lot of applications it's got some uptake, but for audio only it doesn't yet. But when that's available, we're ready to implement it when it seems like it's good to go. Thanks for your attention. I appreciate it very much.